The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Hi, everybody. Thank you for your patience. Just a few house rules before we get started. As always, if you could turn your cell phones off, please. And we will have a book signing upstairs following the presentation. However, due to an exceedingly tired arm, we're going to limit the signing to the copies of the hardcover copies of The Shame of the Nation, which Jonathan Kozel will also personalize. And I just want to go over a few upcoming events. Many of you, I'm sure, have the handout for Barbara Boxer, who will be here on December 8th to talk about her new novel, A Time to Run. On November 1st, National Book Award nominee E.L. Doctorow will be here for the march. November 8th, Marilyn Robinson for her Pulitzer Prize winner for 2005, Gilead. Do you really need me to speak louder? Yeah? Paul, can you turn it up just a wee bit? And on March 28th, this year's Booker Prize winner, John Banville, will be here. And we're off. Jonathan Kozel began his career as a fourth grade teacher in a poor neighborhood of Boston in the mid-1960s. That teaching experience formed the basis of his indispensable book, Death at an Early Age, which won the National Book Award in 1968. In the decades that have followed, Kozel has been one of the country's fiercest defenders of our public schools, an outspoken critic of the voucher system, and a close friend and ally to school teachers. He continues to condemn the inequalities of education in our nation and speaks tirelessly of the apartheid system that isolates Black and Hispanic children in environmentally unhealthy neighborhoods and schools. Until we and the politicians heed his call, please welcome Jonathan Kozel.
Thank you. Thank you to, I see a lot of friends here, and I'm really grateful. It's wonderful to find a crowd packed like this. I mean, those of you in the back, thank you for having the loyalty to just stand there. Are you sitting, and are you just very tall? I can't tell. And thanks also to all you who couldn't get in and who are watching us from some mysterious room upstairs. I don't know whether it's an auditorium or a hallway or something, but whoever you are, whatever species, whatever you look like, I want to meet you all afterwards. So come around at the end when I'm doing books, because that's the fun for me, you know, is to get to meet you. That's what I like the best. I also want to thank Joan Mandel, wherever she is, for she's a representative of my publisher, Random House, which is, Random House is basically very sadistic. They have me write this book, and then they send me on a book tour that's going to last 80 days. 80 days. And it's like first you write the book, and then they try to kill you, you know what I mean? But I'm very grateful to Joan for welcoming me to the airport last night with a giant box of sugar frosted flakes, which is a big box of... It's my favorite secret medicine against physical exhaustion. U.S. Airways, high-stakes examinations, and scary people like John Ashcroft. So, thank you, Joan. Are there any teachers here, or people who intend to be teachers or have been teachers? Whoa! Great. Hooray. And are there students here, real live students? Yes. Great. Great. Well, I'm delighted that there are real students, and especially teachers, and I say that for the following reason. I feel very, very close to teachers. I have a special bond. I know most of you students are high school students, I suppose, but I have a special bond to elementary school teachers, the ones, you know, who work with little kids. Because that's what I used to do. I used to teach little kids, and I just think they do the best thing there is to do in life, which is to bring joy and beauty, mystery and mischief to the hearts of little pint-sized people. And I always like it when I visit a school. Typically, I get trapped in the principal's office. I like the principals. A lot of us are old friends, but they like to trap visitors in their office. And so then, usually I'm lucky. Some teacher knows me or thinks she knows me or sort of knows me, grabs me and rescues me, grabs me by the arm and says, come on, visit my class. And that's what I love, like first grade class. And then when we get there, she puts me on the spot. I say she, because it's usually a woman, puts me on the spot and says, okay, teach something. You know, like, let's see if you can still do it. And then I always do it wrong because I forget. And I typically ask the kind of question that gets everybody jumping out of their chairs, you know, like the kids are, you know, little kids, especially 7-year-olds, 6-year-olds, are like, they have only a theoretical connection to their chairs. And I don't know how they defy the laws of gravity. And they're all jumping up and typically waving their hands, and usually like one right in front of me. It's probably somebody like you. There's like a little girl right in front of me who'll be waving her hands right in my face, like she's going to poke my eyes out with her fingers, and she's making these terrible sounds like, ooh, ooh, ooh. So you'll call on her, ooh, ooh. It's like she'll die if you don't call on her. And so I call on her to save her life. And then she looks up at me with this sweet look of utter bewilderment, and she says, what? She just wanted me to call on her and didn't have a question. It's a humbling experience, and it's good to go back and do the real thing every so often. I sometimes think that every arrogant politician in our nation's capital, including the president, who talks so condescendingly about the alleged failings of classroom teachers in our nation, ought to be obliged to come into an inner-city classroom once a year and teach the class and find out what it's like. It's all too easy to forget. Mr. Bush accuses teachers in our urban schools of harboring low expectations for their students. Now, I don't know many teachers who conform to this peculiar stereotype. There are a few, of course, but the vast majority of the teachers I meet are dedicated. They, especially these young and altruistic teachers and older teachers who are young in spirit, who come into these schools precisely when they could teach anywhere they wanted. They could get jobs in places like New Hope or, or any one of those ritzy places where my Harvard classmates live out in Bucks County. They could teach out there with half the number of students in the class, sometimes twice the pay, but they don't, because I'm talking about these wonderful young people. I recruit them everywhere I go, who want to teach in the inner cities because they believe in racial justice and they believe in the potential of black and Latino kids. They're convinced they're as smart as anybody else. They get a decent chance. And they come into these schools precisely out of the highest possible expectations for these kids. And the president, you know, has the nerve to say to them that the problem with you is you need to strive for excellence. He keeps saying this. Like, strive for excellence. As you know, as though we poor Dumbo teachers came to this career out of like a secret genetic preference for mediocrity. I mean, we were really after mediocrity all along. Excellence. Thank you, Mr. President. We never thought of that before. You know, and then if the test scores don't magically jump 5 percentage points, even though we have 40 kids in a class that holds 28, that's supposed to hold 28, even though our kids get no pre-K, even though that means preschool, you know, for the civilians here, and even though our kids are in often buildings that no CEO would agree to work in for 1 hour, because they're so dirty and squalid, you know, if our kids' test scores don't jump 5 percentage points, he accuses us of the soft bigotry of low expectations. And he says that a lot. It's like once he finds a phrase he can pronounce, he keeps repeating it. Anyway. My friends, in terms of elemental racial justice in our public schools today, we stand at one of the most reactionary and most dangerous moments in our nation's history. Segregation of black and Latino kids has come back to the public schools with a vengeance straight across America. I've just spent 5 years visiting 60 public schools. In the inner city schools I visit, whether they're in Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Chicago, Cleveland, St. Louis, L.A., wherever, I never see white children, to be honest. I just don't see any white kids at all. So these aren't like sort of segregated schools. These are real segregated schools. I mean, if you took a photo, a color photo of the classes I visit, the photo would look exactly like those old photos some of us remember from old textbooks of classrooms in Alabama and Mississippi in 1925, 1930. The percentage of black kids who go to really integrated schools, truly integrated public schools today, is now at its lowest level since 1968, the year that Dr. King was killed. The most segregated state in America for black and Latino kids is New York. New York City is the epicenter of apartheid schooling in America today. Ironically, the most integrated state in America used to be considered part of the old South, Kentucky. And that's because Louisville, Kentucky, had the great moral courage, initially under force of law, but ultimately voluntarily, to simply break down the artificial borders between city districts and immediately surrounding suburban districts, created one huge district. It's called Jefferson County. There's no Louisville school system. The Jefferson County school system, in which the average black student goes to a school in which about 2/3 of the kids are white. A nice balance, which sort of reflects the population of the state. Black kids who go to these integrated schools have like 2 or 3 or 4 times the chance of graduating in 4 years and getting into four-year colleges as the kids in inner city schools like Cleveland and Philadelphia and Chicago. As a result of that one fact, Kentucky is the most integrated state in America. I walk into these schools, and I'm going to be very gentle about Philadelphia today because, you know, because you live here. And I like this city. I like to be invited back. So if I say any really awful things that make like white people feel uncomfortable, just assume that I mean all the rest of the country, but not Philadelphia. Okay. But you know, everywhere I go, I walk into these hyper-segregated schools, and I'm going to get beyond this because there are other issues I want to get into that I know teachers and kids here care about. But I walk into these schools, and you know, I'm old enough, so I sat in front of Dr. King. I remember when he came to my hometown of Boston, and I was a young civil rights worker and a young teacher, young white guy. But the black leadership invited me to be one of his bodyguards. I still remember that because they didn't need me. You know, look at me. You know, the ultimate Harvard dweeb. And they had big guys. But they just did it, you know, out of sense of camaraderie. And I was very grateful for that. And I still remember his words. And, you know, Dr. King didn't say, like, I have a dream that someday in our segregated northern cities we'll have, like, small segregated schools. That's trendy this year. Or someday in our segregated northern cities we'll have segregated and unequal schools with children drilled all year for test scores. Or, you know, someday we'll have segregated and unequal schools where black kids are held to a different standard of discipline than everybody else in America and forced to march around the building wearing uniforms and behaving like little examination soldiers. That wasn't Dr. King's, you know, some people may prefer those approaches, but that wasn't the dream. The dream was someday little black children, little white children would sit together at the table of brotherhood. And I go into these schools and I never, ever, ever see it anymore, except in places like Kentucky. Typically, in New York, you know, I walk into a classroom, I look around me at the faces of the children, some of whom in the Bronx, in the South Bronx, I've known since they were born, because I've written several books about that neighborhood. And I look into their eyes, if I have the courage, because it's hard to do that sometimes, because they look right into mine also. Little kids search the eyes of grown-ups, as you know. And I try so hard to tell myself that this postmodern and millennial apartheid is what Dr. King and all our other martyrs died for. 0.2%. In New York, the schools I visit in New York got 99.8% black and Latino, in case you're curious. I say this because a lot of extremely hostile conservatives, really mean conservatives, there are some nice conservatives somewhere. I don't know where, somewhere. But the ones that debate with me are mean, horrible, horrible people. And they always remind me of George Will, with his spooky glasses, and look like German scientists who are about to eviscerate me, about to do something strange, experiment on me or something. And I have to debate them on TV sometimes because, you know, every TV show needs one liberal. So if the other six are unwell that day, they call me. And these guys are really mean. I mean, in the dressing room before a TV show, usually people chat with one another. They don't. They're just going through their index cards. It's like watching a verbal homicide in preparation. You know, no, you're the victim. But the odd thing is, even though they're kind of a nasty crew, they, some of them like me. I don't know why, because I don't like them. But they'll try to make it easy, and they'll say, well, Jonathan means well. I'll say, well, Jonathan seems like a kind person. Jonathan, at least he spends the time with the kids, so he must like them, you know, something like that. And then they say, but the trouble with Jonathan is he doesn't give enough statistics. He only writes about the things he knows. So I said, this time I'm going to fool them and get me some statistics. And I did. And I'll tell you what they are if you're interested. There were 11,000 kids in the South Bronx neighborhood elementary schools at the time I last checked. Of those 11,000, guess how many were white? 26. So I'm not too good at arithmetic because I went to a progressive school. But that's, I can do long division. That's a segregation rate of 99.8%. And 0.2 of one percentage point now mark the difference between legally enforced apartheid in the South of 50 years ago and socially and economically enforced apartheid in our northern cities now. And one of the real heartbreakers, and black folks say this to me all the time, they say, if you're coming to our city and you want to see a really segregated school, just ask for one that's named for Martin Luther King. Chris Rock has a joke about that, too, as some of you may know, a very good one, same point. Or else they're named for Rosa Parks or Thurgood Marshall. New York has a almost totally segregated school named for Jackie Robinson. What a tribute to the man who integrated baseball, hey? A few of these are good schools. Most of them are not. Most of these schools named for Dr. King, Rosa Parks, etc., are in ugly, old, antiquated buildings, have the lowest funding, largest class size, least experienced teachers, which means lowest paid teachers, and the lowest graduation rates. And they're just, I visit them, they smell also. Kids always say to me, if you have to use the bathroom, don't use the faculty one, use our bathroom. We want you to know what life is like for us. Okay, I do what the kids tell me. And I always wonder why we name these horrible, ugly, smelly, segregated schools for people that black folks love. Why not name them for people they don't like? Like William Bennett School of Personal Morality. Something like that. Clarence Thomas Academy of Self-Help and Self-Hate. Save the name of Dr. King for a school that lives up to his dream. It's my own belief. And virtually all these schools are savagely unequal to the schools that serve the mainstream in America. In New York, just to give you one example, though my new book has a big chart for Philadelphia and the wealthy suburbs surrounding Philadelphia, and you'll see these dramatic differences in per pupil spending between places like Philadelphia itself and towns and areas like Lower Merion and New Hope and so forth. It's just stunning. I don't see how people in those suburbs can sleep at night. What good are their... I mean, their children work hard to win victories, but I know this myself. I grew up in a wealthy suburb. And, what's the chance I would have walked into Harvard College so easily if millions of inner-city kids had had the kind of extraordinary education I was given in a suburb that's very much like Swarthmore, for example, a town like that. So in a sense, I've always known that all my victories in life are contaminated because I won them in a game that was rigged to my advantage from the start. And it's true. And so when decent, earnest college kids, white kids, nice kids say to me after they've read a book like The Shame of the Nation, they say, Jonathan, this upset me. I think maybe I should get involved. I say to them, you don't have that choice. You're involved already. You're part of it already. In New York, the little ones I write about get $11,000 a year. That's a little more than Philadelphia, but not much more. $11,000 a year put into their public schooling, okay? You lift up. Did any of you read my last book about Pineapple? How many remember Pineapple? This is a plump little girl who dominated my last book. She bosses me around. She even got on TV. She bullied her way right onto TV and then bossed the hosts around on television. That's one wonderful little girl. She could manipulate you so well that nobody ever got mad. They just would be fascinated trying to figure out how she could make you do whatever she wants you to do. And when Hillary Clinton came up to the neighborhood to visit, she told Hillary where to stand for the picture, and said, no, over there. And then a reporter was following Mrs. Clinton. like was standing in the background in a photo shoot they were doing. And guess who it was? It was like a man named Robert Novak, who I always get bad dreams if I see him on TV because he's scary. And Pineapple sees him and she says, "You, out of the picture." Oh, bossy little girl. So there's a little Pineapple in all her pint-sized glory, and we're spending $11,000 on her. Lift her up in your grown-up arms and plunk her down in the first suburb, 10 minutes away, just north of the Bronx, lovely town called Bronxville. Instead of $11,000, she'd be getting $19,000 put into her public education every year. Lift her up again and plunk her down in Manhasset, beautiful suburb on Long Island. Be getting $22,000 put into her public education every year. So, you know, my friends, we say in church or synagogue, I happen to be Jewish, we say that all our children are of equal value in the eyes of God. And in the eyes of God, I'm sure they are, but not in the eyes of America. The eyes of America, because of the unjust, unequal, undemocratic way we finance public schools, our children come to the classroom with a price tag printed on their forehead. It's right there. Pineapple was a cheap baby. She was a Kmart baby. You want to see a Lord and Taylor baby, a Neiman Marcus baby, you got to go out to some place like New Hope or Manhasset. These vulnerable children, these little kids, have done nothing wrong, you know? They haven't done anything to offend us. There are a lot of people in every city, who white folks, who say, and one of them called up the radio show I was just on a few minutes ago, WHYY, was it? And you know, some guys, you know, like spoke about how what terrible values they have and all these stereotypes. And a lot of people think, well, black teenagers are scary. Are you teenagers in the front here? Are you scary? No, you're not. You look like angels. Well, the thing is, you know, but these are stereotypes. But nobody can, and see, you know, and late at night, some tall guy might look scary to a white person who's never been in the black community. I lived for 18 years in the black community, and I've never had a moment to be scared. Only time I've ever been beaten up and mugged in my life was by a white guy in Greenwich Village. but these little kids, these little ones certainly, these 6, 7, 8-year-old kids, I mean, they're as clean of sin as a human being could be, right? They're too small to harm us. They're too sweet to hate us. And they're too innocent to know that they maybe ought to fear us. Their only sin, if such it is to be born poor and of the wrong color at a very cold and brutal moment in our country's history. I just want to make a few more brief statements. The consequences of these gross inequalities are seen in aesthetics as well as in many other respects. You know, we usually focus on class size and teacher pay and so forth, which are important things that money buys. But I think aesthetics are important, too, and in the lives of children, especially important. They never talk about beauty in the children. What's the president's testing bill called? No, NCLB. Yeah, no child left untested, I call it. I don't know who dreamed it up. You know, in some school systems now, they're so terrified of Mr. Bush and his testing agenda that they've started giving high-stakes bubble tests in kindergarten. Kindergarten. And the little kids in many of these poor districts, you know, who haven't had no pre-K, Mr. Bush, by the way, has cut Head Start. It now serves, for the first time, less than half the eligible children in the country. You know, every time I hear people say, oh, it's the fault of those inner city parents who can't read to their children or won't. You ever hear that? You know what I say? I said, where the hell do you think those parents went to school? They went to the same segregated and unequal schools their children now attend. And besides, if you really gave a damn about those children, instead of lacerating their parents for not reading to them when they're 2 or 3 years old, you'd universalize pre-K so they had 3 full years of preschool before they came. But it's easier to blame the poor than reach into our pockets and pay taxes. But I think that the aesthetics really count. Little kids take me into their lunchrooms. Now, principals never invite visitors in inner city schools to visit the basement cafeteria. The kids say to me, come on down with us. And one pineapple calls it lunchroom hell. And I do it. And out in Los Angeles, up in the North Bronx, I visited a high school of 4,000 kids where so many kids, they had lunch in 7 shifts. The first shift had lunch at 9:20 in the morning. Isn't that a nice way to treat children? How long do you think we'd keep executives of Bank of America and companies like that if we said your lunch hour is at 9:20? And the filth is something. I visit good suburban schools. I keep going back to compare. And I see the beautiful lunchrooms that look like the lunchrooms at elegant small colleges with little lovely terraces. And they smell nice, and the schools are landscaped. Listen, I think aesthetics counts. Beautiful surroundings refine the souls of children. Filthy settings, ugly settings coarsen their mentalities. Takes a lot of endurance and resilience on the part of inner city kids to maintain the elegance of their souls amidst this dirtiness. This is one of the sharpest ways in which we delineate caste distinctions in America. Just as important as reading skills, in my belief. High school in Los Angeles, I walked into 5,000 kids in the school, so crowded, half had no classrooms, so they had class in trailers. Trailers. In California, they call them bungalows, but they don't look like bungalows. Bungalows are cute, you know, with little flowers growing on them, like Jack and Jill inside. Now, these are ugly trailers. And I walked into a class, teacher had 40 children. 10th grade teacher, 40 kids. She was a good teacher, too. She had 6 classes every day. That's I point up 3 fingers, I say 6. That's what little kids do. You know, they say, I'm 4 years old, the little girl says. 6 classes every day with 40 kids. I said to her, how the hell do you teach 40 children? She said, here, find out. She gave me her class. You see, I don't ask that question. The kids were very moving. It was the last hour of the day, and they asked if we'd stay. I'd stay an extra hour, so we went for 2 hours. And I'm proud of them. I said, I actually did it, 40 kids. But it doesn't mean we ought to do that as a matter of policy in America. Pat Buchanan once said to me, I went to school with 40 kids in my class, and we had tough punishment, and the nuns whipped us and so forth. Didn't do me any harm. These teenage kids were eloquent. To me, they seem like children because I'm so old, you know. One beautiful girl named Mariah wanted to go to college and obviously had college ability. Told me she'd been forced to take a sewing class the previous year. Sewing. And this year she was told she had to take hairdressing. Okay? Have any of you ever been told that or been encouraged to take those courses? No, some have, yes. Well, the thing is, try doing that to the adolescent girls in a town like Scarsdale, New York, or Brookline, Massachusetts, or one of these beautiful suburbs of Philadelphia. But this is a classic for young women of color. She started to cry in front of the whole class. She said, I don't want to take hairdressing. I didn't need sewing either. I knew how to sew because my mother is a seamstress in a garment factory. And I'm saying this now, she could see the pattern repeating, right? She said, I'm trying to go to college. I don't think you need to sew to go to college. My mother sews. I hope for something more. What would you rather take? I asked. I wanted to take an AP class, she said. A dark-eyed boy, brilliant guy named Fortino, would have scared you if you met him at night late, maybe. Looked like, I don't know, he looked like a Latino Malcolm X. You know, he had this brilliant look of kind of cynical intelligence in his eyes. Powerful guy. Look, you know, his words were powerful. He looks right at her and he says, listen, Mariah, the owners of the sewing factories, the garment factories, need workers, don't they? And I guess they do, she said. They're not going to hire their own children for those jobs, are they? Said Fortino. Why not? One of the kids said. So they can grow beyond themselves, Mariah answered. But we remain the same. You're ghetto, said Fortino, so we send you to the factory. A final comment about the president's testing bill, high-stakes tests. Principals in many segregated schools now live in a state of continual anxiety. Any principals here? Well, I can tell you. I mean, I know wonderful principals everywhere. Some of my closest allies are inner-city principals, and they live in continual anxiety because they are asked to essentially perform the biblical miracle of making bricks without straw. They're told you have to pump the test scores, but, says Mr. Bush, no, you don't need to reduce class size, no money for that. You don't need to give your kids pre-K before they come to you, no money for that. And certainly we're not going to waste Texas billionaires' money on giving you clean school buildings to go to. So the principals are in a state of terror. They have to pump the scores like 5 percentage points. It's always 5 for some reason. There's nothing very original in education. I always say, like, why not like 5.5 points or 3 2/3? It's always 5. And the worst is the result that teachers undergo because the principals, terrified, are often induced to hand the teachers what are basically scripts to read, scripted lesson plans. Have you ever heard of this? The worst of all of them in America, by far the worst, is known as SFA, Success for All. Just a disaster. It's like a neo-fascist form of pedagogy. It's based on pure Skinnerian ideas, B.F. Skinner, rat control psychology, sometimes used in prisons in changing the behavior of prison inmates and now applied to black and Latino kids in inner city schools. Another awful one is called Open Court. The thing is, the teachers have no opportunity to contribute anything of their own. These curricula are called teacher-proof. What a wonderful way to welcome, a brilliant young graduate of University of Pennsylvania or Swarthmore who comes into the classroom and, here, this is teacher-proof. It's so good, even somebody as stupid as you can't ruin it. That's basically awful. And they hold timers in their hands sometimes. It's not 1 minute of the day can be wasted. Teacher can't say, I read an early lyrical poem by Gwendolyn Brooks or William Butler Yeats to my third graders, and they loved it. No, you're not allowed to say that because you don't do anything for love. And there's no word love, beauty, happiness. None of those words are in NCLB. The NCLB was written by joyless people to create a joyless nation, I think. You read about rigor, punishment, sanctions. You won't find the word happiness anywhere. You can't enjoy William Butler Yeats. Instead, the teacher has to do it this way. I'll say Yeats. How many of you have read the work of W.B. Yeats and think he's a fairly good poet? How many have read Gwendolyn Brooks? I love Gwendolyn Brooks. I loved her. I still keep on my wall a handwritten letter she wrote me just before she died. I'm very proud of that friendship. You can't say, okay, let's stick to Gwendolyn Brooks. You know, you can't say, I read an early poem of Gwendolyn Brooks and the kids loved it. No. What you have to do is this. You have to say, I used, typically the teachers aren't even allowed to say used, utilized. That's ed jargon. I utilized a poem of Gwendolyn Brooks to deliver the following seven skills on the Pennsylvania state standards that'll be on exams. So, and even like an old classic like The House at Pooh Corner. Anybody ever read that? Or Winnie the Pooh? I was asked by a newspaper yesterday the book that influenced me most in my life. And I said, it's a toss-up between The Sound and the Fury and Winnie the Pooh. I love it. And I said, but even the soft perplexities of Pooh and the sorrowful pronouncements of Eeyore. Remember Eeyore? Poor donkey without a tail, you know. One of the great tragic figures of literature. Up there with Lear and Macbeth. And even these can't just be enjoyed for their incandescent beauty. Instead, they have to be excavated like a kind of quarry in order to extract Pennsylvania State skill number 26B, which the poor teacher has to actually write the number on the blackboard. Somebody say that's right? A total waste of time. It is of no use to the child to do this. I see you coming, Andy. You're not going to stop me, though. These numbers are just a total waste of teachers' time and children's time. I see teachers in New York do this. Teachers teaching a storytelling lesson. She can't, and he, it was a guy in this case in the Bronx. On the wall it says, outcome, ELA, that means English Language Arts. But this is from New York. ELA number 67 something subtopic B. Children will demonstrate the ability to produce a narrative procedure. So I said, well, I told the teacher, I said, I went to a pretty good college. I majored in English. I don't know what that means. He said, it just means to write a story. You know. But I said, well, why don't you say that on the board? He said, no, you have to do it in the pretentious language, where I'm paraphrasing him, of the people who write these standards, because otherwise, if the superintendent or somebody comes around and doesn't see it written in their words with the right number, they will take that as subversive behavior on your part. And look, to teachers here, if you're asked to do that, to write this stuff in language, no little third grader could ever understand, so it's no use to the child. And to put a number up next to it every time. Who said you have to do that here too? Yeah, that's crazy. No little girl is going to come back to you when she's 40 years old and say, "Oh, Miss O'Brien, I'm so grateful to you. My life was changed by Standard 27B." You know, that's baloney. Anyway, don't do it. Here's my answer to you. I don't want you to get fired. I want you to use every bit of mischievous creativity you can to keep your job, because I want good teachers to stay. But if they ask you to do something as lunatic as writing these numbers on the blackboard that have no value to the children, I quote the wife of our former President Bush, just say no. You know, don't do it. And well, I think that a lot of this is dreamed up by poorly educated, mechanistic, managerial business types. Not all business types are mechanistic. There are any businessmen here, I'm sure you're the Renaissance man, but the others are like that, most of them. And it's by school officials who are even lack the pride in the profession to call themselves school superintendents, but have to borrow some, you know, phony luster from the business world by pretending that they're CEOs. I'd cringe when I hear a principal even say, "Oh, I'm not the principal, I'm the CEO of this building." And you think, good God, you know, we have a beautiful profession. Don't let it be distorted and degraded and cheapened by borrowing this false vocabulary and terminology from the world of avarice and profit. We didn't come into this career in order to make money. If we did want to make money, we would have gone to business school. That's what I tell boring college graduates to do. I say, you go to business school, the interesting ones become teachers, you know. I never urge dull people to be teachers. So, but you guys who obey all the rules, you go to business school. And the thing is that this is taking the guts out of the profession. I'm telling you, none of these wonderful, poetic, inspired young teachers are going to stay in schools like Philadelphia and Chicago and so forth. You know what they're going to do? They'll stay for 2 or 3 years, because a lot of them have read my books, and so they're high. They get high on, I don't know, you get high on a sad book, but they do. So they stay there for a few years, and then they quit. They say, I can't take it anymore. I didn't come into this career to be like a drill sergeant for the state or a branch manager for the corporations. I thought that this was a ministry of innocence that I was entering. And you know what happens? They end up teaching in exclusive prep schools. They'll be hired at Germantown Friends, you know, because they want teachers like that. They're going to end on a very personal note. It's tough for me to make this book tour right now because my mother's very fragile and my father's fragile. They're both alive. My dad's 99, and my mother, and he has Alzheimer's. My mother's 101, and she's still very, very sharp, clear-headed. She'll be 102. A lot of her family is from Philadelphia, from Jewish family that had a large branch in Philadelphia. But she grew up in Boston, and she's still very sharp, and she's very bossy. She bosses me around still. Like, I get it from Pineapple, got it from my mom. She looks at this necktie before I left town last month. She says, "You're going to go on TV with that? That?" Then she says, "I used to think only Jewish mothers do this, but I now realize all mothers do this if they can, you know. African-American mothers do this." She says, "Do me a favor. Go to a decent store like Lord & Taylor. Buy yourself a new necktie. Charge it to me." At her age. My mother is a fanatical Red Sox fan. You know, I realize you have different loyalties here. But I bet there's one you share with her. She absolutely hates the New York Yankees. You know, she just hates them. And I look at my mother's eyes sometimes and I think, my God, my mother's lived a whole century, you know. She was a little girl before Woodrow Wilson was heard of. She was a little girl long before the stirrings of World War I. My mother was a 14-year-old in eighth grade the last time the Red Sox won the World Series. This has been my best friend in the world, a rock of strength for my entire life. And to be honest, I can't bear the thought of losing her. I pray, just like a six-year-old, that my mom will live forever. But of course, I know she can't. None of us can. We all know we're going to die and lose the ones we love the most to death, the old trees and the infinite playfulness of children will outlive us all. My friends, life goes so fast. Use it well. Thank you. God bless you. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. Thanks. Thank you, Ozzy. Thank you. Thanks.
So, are you going to do 10 minutes of questions?
Folks, thank you very much. We have time for about 10, 15 minutes of questions. I would ask the following, that if you have a question, you keep your hand raised and wait for the microphone. I will point you out. I will try to get to as many of you as I possibly can in this very short period of time. And also, please make your questions as succinct as possible so that we can get more questions in. And afterward, as I said, we'll go up for the book signing. First question, please. Right down here in front, this gentleman.
Hi.
Hey, how are you today?
Good.
I have a question and a comment. I believe that the American school system, as we know it, in particular, the one that we find in the inner cities of America, is bankrupt. And I say that because I think it's based on an outdated mode of approach to education. I mean, I know it started during the Industrial Revolution. It was standardized and supposed to be more like working in a factory. And
that's right.
And I don't think that works today. You know?
No.
I'd like your comment on that. And secondly, I don't have any expectations that privileged people in America would give up that privilege, you know, without some sort of struggle.
Okay, good.
I really don't. I've seen altruistic people, you know, and I know they exist out there. But on a whole, by and large, I don't think it's going
to
happen.
I'm going to give quick answers to those. On the first issue, yes, you're perfectly right. Actually, what we're seeing today in the whole standards accountability regime that's making life so miserable for the best teachers is an exact repeat of what was introduced in the United States from about 1905 to 1920 by the first business model standards movement, believe it or not. Any of you would like to learn a little of the history of it, read up about people like Edward Thorndike and and Elwood Cubberley. All this is in a book that's in this library, better be in this library, called Education and the Cult of Efficiency. It's a classic book. And all this happened before. And last time around, it was accompanied by a movement called the eugenics movement. Any of you remember what that was? It was also accompanied by the birth of IQ testing. That's when IQ testing was developed. It was developed by a man who said that on the basis of the first test he gave in Memphis, it was clear that black and Native American people were retarded and ought to be educated in segregated settings. They could be trained, he said, for useful employment. He might have suggested sewing, for example, like poor Mariah, but not for more demanding skills. Interesting how history repeats itself. And as for the other point, I completely agree with you. I think it's going to take a massive political struggle, another civil rights movement, to reopen this issue, to force Americans to deal either with the promises of Brown versus Board of Ed, to abolish apartheid educational segregation, or even to get up to Plessy, which promised us equal, but separate, but equal. We don't have either. And it's going to take a struggle, and it's going to have to come both from young people of color and altruistic and ethically motivated Judeo-Christian inspired white folks as well. It's going to have to come from all parts of the population. On basis of the crowds I've seen on this book tour, which are the largest crowds I've seen since 1968, I am convinced that there's a wellspring of support for another great, great struggle in this nation. And I hope I live to see it happen. And I tell young people, the age of you young folks here in the third row, I tell you, I hope you'll start it soon so I'm still young enough to come out and be there with you and join you. Okay.
Lady right here on the aisle in the turquoise shirt.
Hello. First of all, I can't get through your book because I read it on the train and I cry so much people move away from me. You're my hero. I'm a school board member in an inner ring suburb. The population of my district is 60% white and 40% people of color. My children's schools, and I'm the only member of the school board who sends their children to public school, are in classrooms that are between 85 and 90% minority. So I send my kids to an apartheid school. And I've been talking about geopolitical apartheid education for a long time.
Sure.
But what I'm looking for is I'm looking for the Neil Postman teaching as a subversive activity. I want your handbook. This tells us what is.
Yeah.
I want you to tell us about the people you meet who aren't giving the silent hand signals.
Very good.
I want you to tell us about all of those heroes who are behind the scenes risking their jobs and loving children.
Good. But you haven't gotten to the last chapter, have you?
I can't.
But wait.
I can't try and read at the same time.
Okay, wait till you get to the last chapter. It's called Treasured Places. It's an entire long chapter about subversive teachers. I call it creative mischief.
Well, I'm one of those school board members who is subversive, and I'm going to keep working at that with my colleagues.
Good. Good for you. Good for you.
Great. There's a young gentleman right in the middle here in a blue shirt. Somebody speak, please.
Okay, I will.
Just speak loud if you can't get near a mic.
Okay. I wanted to know if you were familiar with the Brazilian scholar Paulo Freire.
Mm-hmm.
And do you believe that his teaching techniques are effective enough to use today, given that we are in a poverty-stricken situation like the farmers Freire taught?
Okay. I'm going to repeat your question, okay? Am I familiar with the Brazilian educator Paulo Freire?
Yes.
And do I think his teaching approaches would be appropriate in our situation, dealing with people in poverty just as he did in Brazil, right?
Yes.
I'm not only familiar with his work, he was like a father to me. I met him when he came out of exile in Brazil in 1968 in Mexico. I was invited down to meet him when he had just emerged from exile, and meeting him changed my life forever. His most famous book is called The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. It's a very powerful book. I had the great honor that he moved to Cambridge the next year, and Harvard, of course, didn't give him tenure, but they kept him for a year. And while he was there, he asked me to review the English translation. They were translating the book into English that year, and I tried occasionally to suggest a way to make it a little easier to read in English, because it's a difficult book. His ideas, some of them are limited to rural, are specifically limited to rural Latin American situations, but the heart of his book, the idea of finding the motivation that already lies within the soul of a student rather than trying to impose it externally by these Skinnerian devices that your Philadelphia, I won't say speak ill of the superintendent here, but that some educators favor, I'll put it that way. Freire is the best antidote to Vallis and company. And I would say that the two people who have influenced me most in education my whole life are, and they'll surprise you, they seem very different in some ways, are Paulo Freire and guess who? Man, I bet you'd all love to spend a day of your life with, Fred Rogers. Yeah. Mr. Rogers came up to the Bronx with me once to meet the kids, and we became close friends. One of the little boys in my book, as soon as he saw Mr. Rogers, he charged across the room and gave him a huge hug and kiss on the forehead, looked him right in the eyes. He says, welcome to my neighborhood, Mr. Rogers. Okay.
So lady all the way in the back in the sunglasses here.
Yeah.
Please use the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Okay. I feel like a Quaker because I'm shaking. I listened to you in the car, and my brother just opened a urban choice school in inner city Rochester because of you. And I remember when he read your first book. At any rate, I wanted to know what advice you could give to somebody like me. I don't have a college degree. I'm a single mother with three kids. I've lived in North Philadelphia, Kensington, for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
My income is below the poverty level. And I'm also an artist, an illustrator, and a painter. I have my kids all go to public school. I have snuck into many public schools, both in my own neighborhood and here in Center City. They've invited me in to do holiday projects, which I said I would do, and then I refused to do because they're exclusionary.
Good.
Yeah, really.
What's the question? I love to listen to you,
Sorry. So my question, I guess, is what kind of advice could you give to someone like me who my plate is full. I want to enlist the aid of people who believe in what you believe in. And how am I able to do it given that I feel...
alone, I bet.
On every level. And I have... not only do I do artwork with kids, it's gotten shown like in major galleries in the city, and still nobody seems to.
Let me give you a quick answer, and I don't mean to cut you off. And we can talk more if you hang around for the book signing. Love to chat with you later in more detail. Look, people feel alone everywhere, but you'd be amazed if you knew how many people think they're alone. I must have met 3,000 or 4,000 people who think they're all alone in these convictions in the past 3 weeks. So you're not alone. The thing is to find like-minded spirits. And one thing I do at the end of every event I'm doing across the country, I have a sign-up sheet, and we're going to create a network of people from coast to coast. Merely in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Seattle, and Denver, collected the names of perhaps 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 people, these masochists who not only sit through my lectures, but then sit up with me till 2 in the morning. And we're going to find some way to put these people together into a network you can mobilize. We're going to turn this book tour as much as possible into the beginnings of a political movement. And so stick around.
Folks, we have time, I'm sorry to say, for 2 more questions only. I want to go to this student right here in the 4th row.
Nice and loud. Hi.
In your book, The Shame of the Nation, you had mentioned about the kids that had to wait in lines, like to go to the cafeteria, and they had to wait in lines for about 30 minutes. I want to know, did you ever go to a school and had to do that?
Did I ever go to a school and have to do that also? Okay, very good question. No, when I was a child, I grew up in a wealthy suburb, and that would have been unthinkable, except by some weird mistake, you know. That would never, almost never happen. But, of course, the suburb I grew up in, kids weren't asked to have their lunch at 9:20 in the morning either. And they didn't have 40 people in a class. They had typically 16 or 18 or 20. And as you probably know, the very expensive private school that George Bush attended, which is called Andover, I live near there, class size is only 12. Can you imagine that? I sometimes think, I don't know, I don't mean to be unkind to the president, but I sometimes think that while Mr. Bush was at Andover, the English faculty was on leave, temporary leave. I've never been through that, but I've seen it repeatedly in big inner city schools. The one that I described to you was where they were so confused. This was in the Bronx, this high school. The one I described in my book that you're referring to was so frantic. The feeling down there was so frantic, it degrades everybody. And then people say, oh, look, the kids act like animals. And I say, yeah, you treat them like animals. They're going to react with desperation and frenzy and justify. And then these conservative critics say, oh, look at these kids. What can you do with them? I don't ask what can you do with them. I ask, what have you done to them? And why do you keep doing it?
One more question, this fellow right here.
Yeah, I wanted to know.
This is the last question?
Yes.
Okay. Make it beautiful.
Beautiful.
Okay.
The the Raleigh school system, North Carolina, how they reorganized their...
I couldn't hear you speak.
The Raleigh, North Carolina school system has reorganized their...
Raleigh, yeah, you're referring to the story in the New York Times 2 weeks ago.
Exactly. I want to know if you've come across that anywhere else, what you think about it.
Quick answer. I've been to, in the last chapter of my book, one of the schools I describe is in the Raleigh-Durham area. It's in Durham, actually, which Durham is the, Durham is one of the most integrated school systems in America, by the way. Raleigh is just beginning it now. Because the federal courts have suddenly decided, these right-wing courts that we're stuck with now, ever since Nixon put his people on the courts, and then Reagan and Bush Sr., you know, gave us Rehnquist and Scalia and Justice Clarence Thomas and so forth. I don't mean to speak ill of the dead in the case of Rehnquist, but I won't speak of him at all. But the fact of the matter is that these courts have made it impossible, almost impossible, to do integration for racial reasons. So, because it sounds like it's preferential kindness to black people to let them go to the same schools that our senators and congressmen go to, their children go to, you know. It's preferential. So, to get around it, in Raleigh, they're using economics as an economic level as a factor for integration. Since overwhelmingly black schools are also overwhelmingly economically the poorer schools in terms of parent family income, it's a distinction without a difference. So if this economic integration works to get around the court, I'm all in favor. What the Times story did indicate clearly was that integration has paid off in very clear-cut success rates for minority children. And I already was aware of that because I've taught in both kinds of schools. I started teaching in totally segregated inner-city Boston school system in which probably only 30% of the kids graduate high school at the normal age and go and get into four-year colleges, 20% maybe at best, to four-year colleges. Whereas out in the suburbs where I next taught in a voluntary integration program, the 95% of the minority kids graduated in 4 years and went to four-year colleges. I really think, you know, it's unfashionable. The Warren Court was right. Segregated schooling is inherently unequal, and I'll do anything I can to help you guys within it. But I'm not going to spend the rest of my life just trying to help to polish the apple of apartheid schooling. I want to lead a massive militant struggle to achieve its abolition.
Thank you, Jonathan Kozel. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming, and we'll see you upstairs.
Jonathan. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.